Body with Pat McDonald.
Hello and welcome to episode 42 of Over My Dad Body. I, as always, am your host, Pat McDonald, comedian, but not for the last 9 months or so, and probably not for a bunch more. Hope you guys are doing well. Episode 42. As a huge baseball fan, if you're a regular listener, you know I am a big fan. Whenever I hear the number 42, I think of Jackie Robinson. Well, it turns out we have a former Major League Baseball player as today's guest. Preston Wilson, he had a 30-30 season, which is 30 home runs, 30 stolen bases in the same season. In my opinion, one of the more difficult feats in professional sports. He won the World Series with the St. Louis Cardinals. So we talk a whole lot about baseball, about parenthood. His is an interesting situation where, and we'll get into it, his father, Mookie Wilson, former Major League Baseball player, won the World Series 20 years before Preston did. Also got name dropped on Seinfeld, which I gotta say is almost better than winning the World Series. And so it was great talking with him. Big fan of the way he played the game and really good guy to talk to. Hope you guys are staying safe. Obviously, the holidays are coming. Yes, there is a vaccine. However, it's going to be a long time before most of us get the vaccine. So please, don't gather in large groups. You're possibly indirectly killing people. I know somebody, won't say exactly who they are, who is unnecessarily going to a retail job. Spoke with that person that I know the other day and found that out, which is alarming because they're almost 70 years old. It is unnecessary. So please, any precautions that you can take to stay safe, please do. You'll be happy you did. And next Christmas will be, or Hanukkah, or whatever it is you celebrate, will be significantly more enjoyable when all the people that are alive now are probably alive then. So I'm not going to take up too much of your time. I hope you guys are ready for Christmas or, you know, whatever else you're celebrating. This is a non-denominational show. Please rate and subscribe to the podcast. Have a bunch of really exciting guests lined up for the new year. Next week will be baseball commentator Dan Shulman. I spoke with him recently. He's one of the best in the business. So please rate and subscribe to the podcast. It helps out a lot. Enjoy today's episode with Preston Wilson. Preston, how's it going today? I'm doing great, thanks. Doing great. I'm glad you could take the time to talk to me. I really appreciate that. Between the two of us, we have one season going 30 for 30, or 30 and 30, I should say. So that I'm not going to tell the listeners which one of us had a 30-30 season. They'll have to do their own research. But you mentioned you're currently in Florida, correct?
Yes, I am. Just south of Miami in Coral Gables, probably about 5 minutes from the University of Miami. So we have a whole different weather system than everyone else in the United States. It's probably like about 80 degrees down here today.
Oh, nice. It is not that warm where I am. I'm outside Toronto, and so I'm envious of the weather. Is that where you're from originally?
I'm originally from South Carolina. I think I should stipulate 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case, because I know it's Celsius up there, and I don't want people to think I'm down here boiling. But I'm originally from South Carolina.
Okay, nice. And what was life like growing up there? I mean, did you have any siblings? What was the kind of like the area you grew up in? What was life like there?
Life there was very much different than pretty much anywhere I've ever been in the United States or in the world, really. I was the oldest grandchild for a long time. I think that the next youngest grandchild on my mom's side was maybe 6 years or 7 years after me, something like that, maybe more. So I was the only one for a while that, you know, that grandma and grandpa doted on for a while, but it was a country living. We lived in the South. My grandmother had a vegetable garden out back. We raised chickens in the backyard. My grandfather worked on a farm. So there would be many days where probably from the time when I was like 6 or 7, you know, I was grandpa's little help. I would get on the tractor and go with him to the farm. And I spent a lot of time with them because my dad was playing baseball at the time in the minor minor league. So back then they weren't really making enough money for you to support yourself and a kid. And, you know, my mom would go visit every now and then, but even she didn't really stay there all the time with my dad and, you know, all the places that he played in the minor league. So it was very different. South Carolina is a society that's probably about 20, 30 years behind everywhere else when it comes to technology, when it comes to race relations, when it comes to a lot of things. I mean, I saw my grandfather have to go into the back door for restaurants because he wasn't allowed in the front door. And we're not talking about in the 50s and 60s. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. So it shows you how far behind South Carolina and those little small pocket towns can be. The capital city like Columbia and Greenville, those cities are much more progressive. But when you get those little small towns where not many people come in and out, not much information comes in and out, you get situations like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing that you bring up. And I'm curious, as you know, you're a kid. Is that was racism something that you dealt with often? Because, I mean, I'll see movies, and just for context, before you answer, I live in a place outside of Toronto called Oakville, Ontario. It's about half an hour or so west of the city. So Toronto's very multicultural, probably the most multicultural city on the planet, I think. Oakville is not that way. It's more diverse now, but when I grew up here, it was like 95% white. So I didn't, you know, co-mingle with people of different races simply because there weren't people of different races. So what was that like growing up, you know, so far as racism? Was that something you experienced regularly?
Oh, the thing about it is you experience it, but you don't know you're experiencing it in some ways because it's what you've always lived with. You know, until you get out of that environment, especially as a young kid, you think that that's just the way life is supposed to be. You think that you're supposed to be treated poorly. Now, I'm not going to say that all white people in South Carolina were racist because they were not. I had some very good friends. There were some very nice families who were beyond that. They knew to treat each other the right way. They knew that skin color shouldn't matter. So I'd never speak in race as a blanket statement above anybody. But there were some that felt like they were definitely above anyone else. And frankly, some of them treated the poor white people there badly too, not as badly as they treated the black people, but they treated poor white people poorly. Well, so being, I mean, things that a kid can go through, you know, maybe a great lesson was learned in that, and that is, don't judge someone just because of how they look. My grandfather, who, like I said, worked on a farm, and in my opinion, was somewhat treated as a slave, because I remember my grandfather's boss just come showing up at the house like 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning and just saying, hey, we got to go, you know, and my grandfather's got to get out of bed. So, and there would be times when my grandfather would drive the tractor home from work and drive the tractor right back to the farm first thing in the morning. But that same man who was treated like that told me, hey, everybody's different. I've been treated good by black people. I've been treated bad by black people. I've been treated well by white people. I've been treated poorly by white people. Don't let your first glance at someone allow you to define them. Mm-hmm. Give everyone a chance. And, you know, I've been able to take that through my life. And I'm very thankful that someone who went through what he went through and was in those situations could actually have that type of a mentality.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly. I think that's good. And I can certainly relate to what you're saying so far as, you know, you've been treated poorly by white people and well by white people. I was speaking with another former baseball player, Kevin Youkilis, recently, who is Jewish, essentially saying the same thing about, you know, being Jewish and being black, where in my experience, most of my problems, almost all, have been with white people. So it's just, it's so odd that, we're not going to solve racism, but it's always very confused. I know, maybe we will, but that's not really the the point. It's just something, it's something that's always confused me. The only people I dislike are those who are assholes, regardless of race. But you mentioned your father playing minor league baseball. Your father, for those listening who don't know, is Mookie Wilson, former Met. He played for my Blue Jays. And so he's not your biological father, though, is my understanding in doing my research. And so what was kind of the dynamic there? And was that kind of a difficult period for you family-wise growing up?
I think my family did have a little trouble with it, and I'll explain it. My biological father was actually my father's you know, I was maybe, when I started realizing that there were some issues with my mom and my biological father was probably, you know, 3 years old or something like that. And, you know, it was a bad relationship. There was abuse. There was, you know, my father was a biological father had a bad drinking problem. There was just a lot of bad things. Now, when that broke down, then, you know, my mother got out of that situation from, you know, that abusive situation, that bad situation. And I'm glad she did because she didn't want me in that. She and my father, Mookie, actually formed a relationship. And they had a bond and, you know, he went from, you know, this sounds like a Jerry Springer type talk show type scenario, but, you know, he really did go from being my father to being my uncle. But when I was that young, I have very few memories of my biological father. I mean, my mother gave him every opportunity to see me, to come pick me up. There were a lot of times where he didn't take that opportunity. When he did take that opportunity, there were times where he would leave me with someone else because there were other things he'd rather be doing. So, you know, I don't hold any ill will towards him. I'm always going to love him because, I mean, the part of me is in him. So if I don't love him, I'm not loving myself. Mm-hmm. So I have to, you know, and I take that with me all the time. But, you know, yeah, Mookie's my daddy. When I hear dad, I picture him, his real name, his name is William Hayward Wilson. That's his birth name. So that's my father to me. And yeah, it does cause some problems in the family. My grandmother had a hard time with it. Because, and I mean, I understand how that could look. I understand how it could look like, you know, she was going from one brother to the next or waiting to, but that's not how it played out. But I definitely understand how tense it could be. And I think also my grandmother was having issues with it because my biological father, once he lost my mother, once my mother moved on, he struggled with it. You know, his drinking got even worse. His health got even worse. He actually, I would think he died in 1994 or 95. He passed away.
Oh, geez.
Bad kidney. So, you know, I mean, the issues that he had throughout his life kind of caught up with him. You know, it's just one of those things. And I trust me, I talked to my mom a lot of times. And as a kid, I would see her crying. And I saw my dad, you know, Mookie, you know, trying to console her. And, you know, some of those times were when my grandmother or my aunts would, you know, have a really hard time with the change that happened in their life. I think it's great. You know, now, even though my grandmother passed away a few years ago, my aunts from my dad's side of the family, my aunts from my mom's side of the family, uncles from both sides, like everybody's a big family on both sides of my family. So that's a good thing. But for a while there, it was really tough on some of the members of our family to understand that how my mom could end up being with my dad and the process that played out, that it wasn't some sneaky behind the back thing going on before that, you know, before my mom left my birth father.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so you mentioned your father, he played Major League Baseball for, I believe, 12 seasons. What was life like? You know, you mentioned when he was in the minor leagues, obviously you're not making much money. So, you know, you can't exactly pick up a family and move around a whole bunch. But he did have a very solid career. And so would you live in, say, New York and Toronto with him? Or were you still in South Carolina? What was that like growing up?
As soon as he made it to the major leagues, I was there. In 1980, when he got called up, came up, 81, I was there. We actually had a little apartment in a duplex right across from LaGuardia Airport. Actually, I could see Shea Stadium from our front yard, the little front yard of the duplex apartment right there. So as soon as he was able to have me there, I was there. But yeah, I remember him playing in like small towns like Jackson, Mississippi, and Norfolk, Virginia, which is weird because I actually ended up playing in Norfolk when I was playing with the Mets. So I played in the same organization, the Tidewater Tides. By then, it was Norfolk. So I played in the same organization. I ended up playing in New York where he played, which was very unique. But it was tough, man, back then in the minor leagues. I remember, even in the big leagues, I remember my father for his first few years, he actually worked as a major league in a restaurant. So he had an off-season job as a Major League Baseball player.
Wow. I mean, that's the kind of thing, you know, I heard a lot growing up because hockey's obviously very, very big here in Canada. Countless stories of, you know, players in, say, the 50s working at a car lot in the off season. But I wouldn't think that a major leaguer in the 80s would have to have a second job. That's interesting. That's something I wasn't aware of. And so obviously I know of you because you played in the major leagues for quite some time. How beneficial and how much would you say kind of a leg up were you given with, what I imagine would be pretty solid access to, playing on the field before the game, stuff like that?
I will never underestimate the advantage I had. Number one, just seeing someone who's at the top of their profession, see how they work, to see how they go about it, to see what it takes to get there, to see working out when nobody's watching, to see, going to that batting cage when you don't need to, like you're not getting paid for off-season work. To see getting other people into it, working out, trying to learn from them while you're working out together. I saw my dad do all that stuff in the off season, and the one thing that that's always stuck me is you have to do the want to work. You have to do the work that doesn't go on the back of your baseball card. You have to do that work when nobody's looking. You have to do that work because you want to get better. And I got that, and also to anytime you can pretty much see something done at the highest level, it's going to help you. I tell people whenever they ask me about stuff like this, I go, and there's architects out right now that only got their degree because they needed to, but they learned from one of the best. So that's how they really got good. The ability to be an apprentice, the ability to be at the foot of someone who is at the top of their profession is invaluable because you get to see it not you get to see it done well, and you get to see it done at the peak that it can be done. Like there is no league higher than the major leagues. So if you can watch someone and be around that and be in that environment, I mean, I got to see Dwight Gooden pitch. I got to see Darryl Strawberry hit almost every day. I got to see George Foster. I got to see Sid Fernandez. I got to see Ron Darling. I got to see Lenny Dykstra. I got to see Huey Brooks. I got to see Ellis Valentine. I got to see people who were amazing, amazing players every day and see little things that they do that got them to the big leagues. So I will never underestimate the value that has added to my life just to be able to see something like that done at that level.
Yeah, I say, what you're saying just in the sense, because I've done stand up for coming up on 13 years. And I completely agree where, when I was very new doing open mics with all my friends, we all started at the same time. And then you incrementally, so then you'll do like a weekend show and then you're doing clubs. And then from there, you're touring the country as I did until the pandemic happened. And I agree completely where once you see, you think you're really good, and then you see someone at the next level and you're picking up on things constantly. It's funny, you mentioned a couple of former Mets, Doc Gooden. I'm wearing a Doc Gooden hat. And Lenny Dykstra, who is a friend. He's done the show and he's an interesting character for sure. And so you were drafted in the first round. But you spent a number of years, I think 5 years in the minor leagues, and you obviously you had a very good Major League Baseball career, but I mean 5 plus years in the minors, was there a time when you're there for half a decade, you are progressing obviously, but were there times where you thought, geez, maybe this isn't going to work out? Or
No, because a couple of those years were injury years. So even though I was in the minors, there were a couple of years where I really wasn't on the field much. I mean, the first year when I played in Kingsport, that's a short season team. I played well enough to get called up to the high short season team, which was they were in the playoffs, so they felt good enough about bringing me there. And then next year I went to Columbia, South Carolina, and even though I struggled there, I still had 20 home runs and 20 stolen bases in that season. But I was learning to play third base. I was playing against better competition. Baseball is one of those games that takes reps, So and then the next year, played it, got better. Did have a little injury, but that wasn't that bad. I think I fractured, broke a hammock bone that year or something like that. So nothing too major. But I did still miss some time. 95, I went to short season A ball. And there I dislocated my shoulder. So
Jeez.
on a check swing, I subluxed my shoulder. So I missed most of that season. After that, 97, I started off the season. First half was in St. Lucie, played well enough, got called up to Binghamton, New York, Double A. second half of the season. I ended that season with, I think, a total of 30 home runs and 95 RBIs between both of those levels. 98, I spent a little bit of time in AAA, and then I got called up for a little, a little stint, a couple weeks stint in 98 when the Mets needed someone. I think Edgardo Alfonso had hurt his back. And then at the very end of 98, after I'd gotten traded to the Marlins, I was called up in the big leagues, and I hadn't been to the minor leagues since then.
Yeah, and you mentioned
So when you look at those years, yeah, it's 5 years, but there was probably a good two to maybe even 2.5 years worth of games that I did not play. You know, there was an elbow injury that I'd mentioned. I broke both hamate bones, believe it or not, in the minor leagues.
Jeez.
You know, one sliding, one swinging. So, yeah, so there were different times where there were a lot of injuries. So probably a good two seasons or so was spent with me on a disabled list. So for me, it was, I never got discouraged. It was for me a more point where I felt like once I got healthy and I could play consistently, I would advance. And that's what it was. Once I got in the infield and learn and play, and honestly, the better competition I played against, the better I played as well. I think some players are chameleons. You put them in A ball, they're going to look like an A ball player. You put them in a big league, they're going to put them in a big league. They're going to look like a big league player. And I'll give you my perfect example of that is a Marcell Ozuna. A lot of people don't know Marcell Ozuna, who's this, you know, free agent top prospect, well, not prospect, but top producing outfielder, all-star, all of this. He had played only 5 games at AA before he came to the big leagues. He was an A-ball player, essentially, when the Marlins called him up. I think he played 5 games at AA, and they needed an outfielder who could actually play the outfield in that big spacious outfield that the Marlins have, and his name got called. He hasn't been to the minor league since then.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some guys who you look at them, you know all the tools are there, but they're pretty much going to adapt to the environment that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those guys.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. And so your first game with the Mets, you go 3-for-4. Was it the kind of thing where you thought, oh, geez, this is going to be easy? And the reason I ask that is because I, you know, my two favorite things are baseball and stand-up. Not much of a career in baseball for me, so I'm sticking with stand-up. And I found the first time, so I would do these terrible open mics when I started stand-up. And then finally, after months and months of trying, I got on the amateur night at the comedy club in Toronto called Yuck Yucks. It's a 300-seater on a Tuesday night. I went in, and for whatever reason, there were at least 200 people. And I went up, my first ever show at a club, did 5 minutes, and absolutely crushed. And I was like, oh, this is easy. It's always going to be great. And they had me back the next week, and it was not very good at all. So did you have a similar experience? You know, you're 3-for-4. You're like, I'm going to hit 750 for the rest of my career.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to applaud you for being such a masochist to enjoy baseball and stand-up. That, my friend, is a rare combination you don't see.
Yeah.
But not that I thought it was going to be easy, but yeah, when I came up to the big leagues, my first two games, I went 3-for-4. So I was what, 6-for-8 my first two games. Ironically, those two games came against the team that I ended my career against, the Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
So I got there, and it was, you know, I never had any illusions that the big leagues was going to be easy. I never had any illusions. I mean, I never hit 300 in the minor leagues. I was, you know, I mean, you got to think about it, though. Before steroids and all of that, nobody was hitting 300 with 30 home runs.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that came about. You know, if you were hitting 300 with 30 home runs before the PEDs, then you were Hall of Famer. That's just bottom line.
Yeah.
That wasn't done. Nobody was hitting 315 with 35 home runs before that, unless you were those Hall of Fame type players. Then, you know, became like a, you know, your average outfielder that was starting, you're going to have a bunch of those guys hitting that. But I never thought that the major leagues was going to be easy. I saw my dad do it. I saw him have good days, and I saw him have bad days. I saw him where it looked like they couldn't get him out. Then I saw him where it looked like he never, like he just got out of bed and never played the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how baseball is. If you play long enough, you're going to have hot streaks, and you're also going to have streaks where the game just kicks your butt. It was nice to get off to a good start like that. It was nice to play in New York those first few games and, like, be in Shea Stadium, the stadium that I grew up in, have those fans, you know, cheering for me like I heard them cheering for my father. Like, that, mm-hmm. that was an amazing thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned being traded. What is that experience like? I mean, I've seen it in movies like Moneyball, for example, where a player is traded or they're released. I mean, you're so new in the major leagues. You've only been there a short time, and then all of a sudden you're being shipped off to Miami. What is that like?
Getting traded is getting your first time. The first time you get traded, it's like leaving school or leaving your home. And when you go to college, I didn't go to college, but when you leave or when you go off to work, that's what it's like. You're in a whole new environment. You don't know the people there. You're doing the same thing, like you're brilliant playing baseball, but everything else is different. So you basically have to learn, you know, how this team operates. You have to learn what their philosophy is. You have to learn the players. Some of them you played against before, but you were just on the other side of the line. So it's really for my situation specifically, it was really odd because every team has their guys that are untouchable. I was because of the year that I had before that, like I said, 30 home runs, 95 RBIs, you know, split between two levels. If I hadn't missed the last week or so of the season, I probably would have driven in 100, but I slipped on a wet field and hurt my back at the end of the season, so they shut me down. So, you know, potentially 30 and 100 guy in the minor leagues, they're like, hey, we're good. That's this guy. Well, there's some Piazza maybe. And they sent me over to the other dugout. But it was weird because I was in AAA, and as luck would have it, I was playing for the Mets one day against the Florida Marlins, and for the next two games of that three-game series, I'm playing for the Marlins against the New York Mets.
Yeah, I've seen instances.
I think I had like two or three home runs in those last two games.
Oh, nice. Really stick it to them. Make them hopefully regret it. I mean, they got a decent return in Mike Piazza, that's for sure.
The guy that, you know, can pretty much carry you into the play. If you're into that, yeah, I'm sure they got a good player for me.
Not my cup of tea, but yeah, to each their own, right? And so you mentioned, you know, you did play essentially through the heart of the steroid era, you know, anywhere, I would peg it from anywhere from 96 to 2004. So you played in the majority of that. I've asked other players, including some who got popped for PEDs. How well known was it amongst players what was going on? And I mean, was it the type of thing where, you know, it's out in the open and guys are injecting each other in the butt, or is it just you have a sneaking suspicion but you just kind of leave it alone? What was the environment like?
Well, it was never that rampant. It was never that rampant where I saw guys do anything. Could you see the difference in people's bodies? Yeah. I mean, and to be honest with you, speaking of Lenny Dykstra, when my dad was in the Mets, Lenny Dykstra, when he came in, he was, you know, 160, 170 something pounds. You know, he came back that next year and he's, you know, 200 pounds too. So everybody knew something. You can't gain 30 pounds in an offseason after you win a World Series. Like, you can't do that. There's not enough time for you to gain 30 pounds of muscle. So yeah, so I mean, there were guys back then that did it. There were guys even older than that did it. I remember watching guys like a Brian Downing, you know, guys like that. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't say it, but, you know, the rumor is, I mean, Nolan Ryan just had some longevity because you look at a lot of teams that he was on, there were a lot of players from those teams that were kind of big, bulky type dudes, and they'd established their careers. And, you know, there was this link between the steroids and the cow farming and all of that, like, cause that was like during that time where they were allowed to do it. You know, so it's been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it really reached the magnitude that it did in baseball until maybe the science evolved a little bit. And Mark McGwire's got that, you know, Andrew Steendione just sitting up there in their locker like, that's cool to have up there. But it's, you know, it's another thing that my family, like my dad and I, kind of shared. We both played against people who used steroids, who used PEDs, and we had to deal with it. And some of them were on our team that we were competing against. You know, we were competing with them, but because they were using PEDs, we were also competing against them.
Yeah.
Because, hey, that's somebody who might potentially take your spot. So, I mean, it sucks. I still don't like it to this day, but I understand why they did it. You know, it's just one of those things where, as a fan, do you accept it? Or do you feel like it was cheating? Do you feel like it, you know, hurt the competitive balance or the integrity of the game? I mean, that's something that's going to be debated for a while, but, you know, I understand why people did it because there are a lot of guys who I know without it, may not even have been in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, may not have had the careers that they had.
Yeah, certainly. I agree. I mean, is it the kind of thing where, you know, you feel animosity towards those who did steroids, or do you more so kind of feel sorry for them, or do you just not feel any type of way towards them?
Feeling animosity towards the players. Does it bug me? Yes, it bugs me, but let's be honest. The players aren't the ones who allowed this. The players benefited from the situation that was set to them. The owners knew this was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell me that the owners who had that team in Oakland that had, you know, Mark McGwire, Jose Canseco, you know, all those dudes who were bulky, that you knew that's not what a baseball player looked like. You know those guys in San Diego who had those big guys in San Diego, Cam and Nitty, like,
yeah.
You know that's not what baseball players look like. So, you know, going to Sosa, like all the McGwires, that's not a baseball body. That and when you look back through the films of baseball, there's never been, those aren't baseball bodies. We talk about weightlifting and all that. Well, there were some big, strong guys that played in the 50s, 60s, 70s that we have pictures of. We have video of them playing. And they were some of the biggest and strongest ever, and they didn't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, they knew what was going on. They knew what was happening. And also, you can see the type of injuries that were happening. We were having injuries happen in baseball that had never happened before. Guys were pulling tendons off the bone. You know,
Jesus.
Like that stuff that didn't happen. Like your body isn't going to overpower itself. Like we have evolved this long where your body's not going to basically break itself. There has to be some more, you know, external things that are coming into it that's going to make your body do that. I don't have any animus towards the players. I think maybe inside me, yeah, it does bug me because I feel like if it was an even playing field, I feel like, yeah, I would have been considered a little bit higher as far as the ranking or esteem that I was held as far as my talents and abilities. But really, you have to look at the cause of it. That's what the owners wanted. Owners wanted more home runs. Owners wanted more butts in the seats. The league wanted that. They saw it happening. They allowed it to happen. And then all of a sudden, when it got out in the press, then they started to act like it was a problem, when in essence, they knew this was happening all along.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly. I agree. I mean, I was a kid. What was it, 98 when Sosa and McGwire, so I would have been 14. And even then, I'm like, come on. Like, there's no way. I'd been watching, you know, I would watch, say, a player like, I don't know, Joe Carter or John Olerud, where they're bigger guys, but, I mean, they're not that bulky. So even as a kid, I could tell the difference. I was like, there is something going on here. And so you moved around, you played in Colorado for a couple of years, led the league in RBIs, which is incredibly impressive. And so you end your career with St. Louis. Your second last season, you won the World Series. What was that season like for you? Because you moved from Houston to St. Louis late in the season, actually, I would assume, without knowing for a fact, I would assume towards the trade deadline, end up winning a World Series. What was that whole experience with St. Louis like?
Well, you know, first, you know, it was a really weird offseason for me after the 2005 season. I think I had 25 home runs and 90 RBI. Like 260, 270 something, you know, which was a power hitting outfield.
Let me just interrupt you and say that if baseballreference.com is hiring, you should be hired because you just nailed all those numbers dead on. That's scary, but please continue.
I'm looking around for a job and trying to find a place where, you know, I could feel like I could land and not only help a team that's contending, but also be in an environment where I could learn from someone else. And I had no idea that Jeff Bagwell's injury was as bad as what it was. They lied to me and told me that it wasn't that bad. They told me that he'd probably be playing. So I took less money to go there, honestly, you know, to go there and play under that environment because I was like, look, there's potential to win here. I can learn from a guy who I think is going to be a Hall of Fame player. And it was the first time that I would be on a team that there was another power hitting right-handed player. I went through my whole career being the right-handed bat in the middle of the lineup. And, you know, that's a hard thing to do when you don't have someone else to learn from. Usually, you know, guys who come in and they have, you know, potential, have the tools, if they can get in an environment with someone who has that similar skill set, it helps them. It shortens the learning curve. But, you know, in Miami, I was, as a rookie, I'm hitting cleanup. When I went over to the Rockies, I was still, I had Larry Walker and Todd Helton, but I was still the right-handed bat in my lineup. I was there to split them up, so that you couldn't just throw in a lefty and, go lefty-lefty and kind of shut them down. I was kind of the wedge for them. So when I signed with Houston, I was like, hey, this is the opportunity that I've been looking for, the chance to have another right-handed batter in the lineup to learn from him. Well, as it turns out, Jeff Bagwell was too injured to even play. So I'm kind of the same thing, but even worse than that, they used me to protect all their young guys, their 1 and 2 year guys like Chris Berg and Jason Lane and Morgan Ensberg. You know, I was in there hitting like sixth and seventh in a lineup where I just came off where I'm hitting, fourth and fifth in Washington, because I went there the last half of the season for the run with them. So I'm hitting sixth and seventh in a lineup for a team that's struggling. And yeah, I'm not getting pitched to. I think I only had like 8 home runs, like for the, when I got traded, so 8 or 9 home runs when I got traded. Fired, got DFA'd. I got designated for assignment in Houston. Just a situation that was just in so many ways bad. I felt like I was lied to in a lot of ways. I also felt like they treated me poorly as far as, how they used me and what they used me for. I felt like they had a situation. We had a situation where our hitting coach, we didn't even have hitters meetings in Houston. They were so concerned. I heard all the talk about how the offense wasn't producing, and they had Clemens and they had Pettit. They had Roy Oswalt. They were, great pitching and holding guys down. They had Brad Lidge in the pen. But at the same time, they weren't scoring any runs. And then I get there, and when the season starts, I'm like, okay, so when are we having a hitter's meeting? And Gary Gatti was the hitting coach. He was like, hitter's meeting? But I'm like, okay, so you're telling me we're a major league club, and we're not having hitter's meetings before the season starts? And I just couldn't believe it. I said, so what are we doing? We're doing all this talk about how poorly the offense is playing, but we don't have meetings?
Yeah.
Like, how do we not, as a group, have a game plan? How do we not have a philosophy about how we're going to approach these? How do we not tell guys how to prepare themselves for this series for who they may face? Like, there's certain guys on the bench who, hey, if it's close and we're ahead, you're going to be the bat off the bench. You know, if it's a leadoff at bat in an inning and the score is tied or we're down by a run, you're going to be the guy. Like, teams need to know that so guys can understand how to go about their work.
Mm-hmm.
Then they can specifically watch those guys on video, know what they throw, what they like to throw in certain situations, how they're going to pitch you, given a situation, whether you're leading off the inning, whether you're coming in with men on base. There's so many scenarios that you need to play out and prepare yourself for, and they weren't doing it all.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally convinced them to have a hitters meeting in June. Major league season. Yes, it's good. Yes. May, June. We finally had our first hitters meeting, and we start the hitters meeting, and the hitting coach Guidy doesn't even know how to have a hitters meeting. So Lance Berkman and I take over and do the hitter. We take the book out, we talk about the pitchers. So we had to do the hitters meeting, which leads me to ask, how in the world are these people getting these jobs? Like, is it because you're a friend of a friend? So that whole situation in Houston was awful. Then I got designated for assignment. Maybe they felt like if they let me go, they could, they were out of it anyway. Not out of it, but they weren't. They knew they weren't going to win the championship. They knew, they had some really good pitching, but they let me go. Maybe they were tired of me, but I know I was. It's the best thing that could happen. And I go from that to going to a team that I really felt like was the epitome of accountability. It was the epitome of baseball. The essence, the thing that I grew up with watching my dad do, making sure you're accountable, making sure you hold each other accountable, making sure the work gets done. It's not a matter of if it's going to get done, it's how it's going to get done.
Mm-hmm.
That was Cardinals baseball for me. Tony La Russa, yes, he has many flaws as far as some of the personal things that have happened with him, off the field, and, some of the stuff we've read about is, his views on race and all of that, a little bit problematic for a while. But I will say this, Tony La Russa was the most prepared manager I've ever played for in my life. There was no situation that ever caught him off guard. And he had an amazing coaching staff with Dave Duncan, just amazing. The outfield coach, Dave, oh my goodness, I love this dude, I can't think of his name right now, but meeting with Dave, who was an outfield instructor, just an absolute great dude, and they love to work. And mm-hmm. even though, at that time in my career, I had a bad knee, I loved to work. Whenever I was good enough, I loved to work. I'd go out there and practice on throwing the bases. So all the stuff that we did and they did, and it was just perfect for me. And we ended up winning a championship. We weren't, when I got there, we weren't the best team. we had pieces that were coming, they were getting healthy at the right time. We had pieces that were, the team was starting to gel. The team started to believe in themselves. And we made it as a wild card team and just kind of pretty much just went on a rampage when the playoffs started. So the year that started out probably with the most hope for me, then it turned out to be one of the darkest situations, ended up with a championship ring. And so, you know, there's something good that can come out of bad things if you stick with it. And, you know, just keep dedicating yourself. So that's what that year was like for me.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a hell of a team. I would say, you know, obviously Albert Pujols is, he's superhuman. Like, that's not, people should not be able to do what he's done in his career. But it's incredible, the talent that guy has. But I'd say that team probably had, in my opinion, three Hall of Famers. You got Pujols, obviously. I'd say Molina. And you're playing the outfield with Jim Edmonds, who I think is supremely underrated, and I do not understand why he's not in the Hall of Fame. I don't get it. What could you kind of learn from a guy like Jim Edmonds playing the outfield? Because he's probably one of the best defensive outfielders ever.
Well, the thing I learned from Jim is that Jim played to his strengths. You know, Jim knew that he went back on the ball well, and that was just so he played shallow. He had a really good arm. And I think he knew himself that he was a little bit underrated. So I think that fueled him. You know, Jim is one of those guys where, you know, he's got a chip on his shoulder. It's a quiet chip. It's mm-hmm. It's not a loud, in-your-face type chip. But, yeah, you tell Jim he can't do it, he's going to try to figure out how to do it. You know, just power. Jim could hit for power. He's great. He would come up big in big spots. You know, just a really good player. One of the best outfielders I played with. The best outfielder I played with, Larry Walker, who's a fellow Canadian of yours.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, just
Hall of Famer.
Jim was great. You know, that team, man, we had guys who, like Juan Encarnacion, sadly passed Duncan, mm-hmm. Chris Duncan, who just passed away this past year, who was a young kid, just had some big hits throughout the season. You know, you look at him and you think, yeah, this kid's a big league ball player, but man, he found a way to get it done. Scott Spezio, who, you know, just a versatile guy, switch hit, you know, play a little third for you. You know, if you need him in the left, you can throw him out there in the left. He always found a way to give you a good at bat in a big spot. Oh, man. There's just so many guys.
You know, yeah.
Scotty, of course, you mentioned Eckstein, David Eckstein, who was he's one of my most dear people that I love on this planet today. Eckstein was one of those guys who, his intelligence about the game and the way that he went about it, maybe it's because he was a poli-sci major, he understood all the ins and outs. And he was always in the right place at the right time. And he would kind of lull you into this little sense of, look at this little guy. He's not fast, he's
yeah.
not strong. And the next thing you know, he's got two or three knocks and, you know, hit a home run, yank you down the line. And you like, he beat us? Yeah. He beat you because you thought you could beat him and you were wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we had a lot of guys, Jeff Suppan, Anthony Reyes, you know, pitchers I'm talking about, Wainwright, who was a rookie at the time, and Jason Isringhausen, who was the closer, hurt his hip, and Jason Isringhausen was mentoring him every day, every step of the way. Izzy didn't even have to be at the ballpark, but he was there talking to Wainwright, helping him through it. So when you have guys like that who are willing to step outside of themselves and help someone else do the job that they would have been doing, it sets you up for a possibility of success. You're not guaranteed to win, mm-hmm. but you're going to be in the best possible situation to do that. Yeah.
No, certainly. Again, the parallels between kind of baseball and comedy. I had that happen when I was very new, where a headliner who'd been doing it for, you know, 15 years, toured the world, showed up to an open mic because I asked him to 2 hours early to help me with joke structure. And I'm so much better for it. So, yeah, that kind of mentoring, certainly it goes a long way. It's essentially an extra tool in your toolbox, in my opinion, when you have people willing to help kind of newcomers. I do want to correct myself. Scott Rolen should also be in the Hall of Fame. He was the third baseman there.
Yes.
So you played former Blue Jay as well.
Real quick, let me tell you something about Scott Rolen.
Yeah.
Scott Rolen was one of the driest, funniest guys you ever were. And so I came to that team, and I played against Rolen a lot with the Phillies. We were in the same division in the NL East for a long time. And yes, I watched him kick our butts quite a bit. But you never really know. You know, and so I met Scott Rolen, and this goes back to my grandfather. Give everybody a chance. you know, first. So I met Scott Rolen. We're talking, and we ended up being really close, man, in that locker room. I mean, just like we had this relationship where I'd see him and we'd share a joke and we'd talk about what's going on with the game. We worked together in the cage, stuff like that. But one of the funniest things during that time was, and it was kind of hard for Scott, because Scott was coming off of a shoulder injury. And Scott was like me. He wanted to play. Even though that shoulder injury was there, he wanted to play. So he and Tony La Russa were butting heads a little bit. And it seemed like every time Scott would come to me and vent about what was going on, La Russa would like come through the room and be right behind us. So after about a month of this, I swear this happened like about 6 or 7 times. Like we'd be like in the cafeteria, like in the little eating room or the meeting room or something, and Scott would be like, "This man," I look at Scott like my eyes would open a little bit. He's right behind me, isn't he? I go, "Yes, he is." I said every time. It was like you just talk about food in the room, and he just appear out of the back
door. Cool. And so following baseball, your last season was 2007. I mean, you're one of the, I don't want to say one of the lucky ones, because, hey, listen, there's luck involved in anything that you do. But, you know, hard work and natural talent, in my opinion, will, in any profession, will make up the vast majority of your results. But you are one of the fortunate ones, let's say that, to have had a fairly long career, and you made a good amount of money. And so what's life been like after baseball, kind of making that transition from, you know, you're playing and now you're no longer playing baseball? Was that difficult kind of emotionally so far as routine goes?
It was very difficult. I mean, you basically die. And I know that sounds really dramatic, but baseball was your life. Baseball was, you know, I can imagine anyone who played Major League Baseball, they played in high school, possibly played in college, they played through the minor leagues. Baseball was their life, and that part of you is dead now. Mm-hmm. So you really have to come to terms with that, and I think that's something that a lot of former athletes struggle with. You see a lot of relationships fall apart. You see a lot of marriages end. And when guys divorce, and it's not necessarily because anyone's there's no infidelity. It's just a matter of fact, your life is different now, and you are dealing with the death of part of what you are, mm-hmm. of what you were. And the person that you're with has to deal with you being around every day now. Those are I've heard a lot of guys go, "Hey, come home from the season." The wife's like, "Hey, no, we got this. You just fill in where you can, but don't come in here trying to take over the lead. Like, I've been doing this for 9 months when we're in spring training or during the season. We got this. You're not coming in here and taking over. You just kind of get in where you fit in." And then that's tough. That's tough for some guys. Mm-hmm. It's tough for other relationships. It's tough for families. I had to deal with that. I went through a depression for a while because I didn't, I felt like I still, after 2007, which I was injured in 2007, I felt like, 2009, I felt like I still could play. I was still only 30-something, in my early 30s, so I felt like I still could play. Didn't really get an opportunity. Nobody would I couldn't even get an invite to spring training.
Wow.
I was pretty bitter about that for a while. I was telling the teams, "Hey, I'll play for the minimum. I'll sign to go to the minor leagues. I'll do it." And I couldn't even get into camp. That's when baseball, that was during a time where you would see no vet. If it was a team that wasn't a championship team, there were no veterans on the bench. You had guys from Double A as your fourth and fifth bat on the bench. And I'm like, how is the team going to get better when they have nobody on the bench, to help, the young guys or see things? But yeah, so I was a little bit bitter. I fell out of love with the game for a while because I felt like it didn't love me. Got depressed for a while, went through that for a while. Just a tough time, man. And then I got an opportunity to start broadcasting, and that kind of drew me back in. I was with the Marlins, and I did Fox Sports Florida. I did some pre and post game, shows for them. I think I started like 40 games a season, started doing that. Then I ended up doing, more games, probably half the season games, pre and post games. Then I got some games in the booth. I had a year where I did 50 to 60 games in the booth as a color analyst doing the games for the Marlins. Then I got a gig at Major League Baseball Network. I think I spent, 3 or 4 years there at MLB Network, which really, that drew me back in. I started to remember why I loved the game and how much I loved the game, and just remembered, how I felt when I was around the game, and being able to share and teach the game really brought that back. you know, and then I had a situation where, you know, I had a, have an 18-year-old, 16-year-old daughter at the time who, you know, when you're traveling as much and me being a co-parent, I was divorced from her mom, me being a co-parent, you know, we divorced, so it was 2004, I think, we divorced, something like that. So we've been divorced for a long time. But, you know, being a co-parent, you know, when I'm here in Florida, you know, she's, we have shared custody. So I would see her for a week. Her mom would get her for a week. I'd get her for a week. Well, if I'm working, that time is gone.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of things that, you know, you need to be around for as a father. And so, you know, it was starting to affect me at work because of things I was trying to deal with. It was starting to affect me personally. You know, I wasn't myself. I was, you know, out of character sometimes. I was, you know, I realized my moods were changing. So I just shut it down. I came back here, spent time with my daughter, trying to get some of that stuff straightened out, trying to make sure she knew that I was there. Trying to make sure that her behavior was back in place. And, you know, I think it was the best thing that I did because it reset myself. It reset my daughter. You know, I'm glad to say she got accepted into Tulane.
Nice.
Which, you know, great university down here. So, you know, she's doing well. I think she's going to be all right. You know, we still have our daddy-daughter scuffle sometimes as far as, you know, her wanting to, you know, hey, she's 18 now. She wants to be a woman, which she is a woman, but I'm still her father. And I think there's certain things that, you know, there's that power struggle that's going to happen. But, you know, the love is always going to be there. You know, she's my first, so she's always going to be number one.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, I feel like those are things that players deal with. You know, when you leave the game, your life changes. And I, you know, I was like, I went to therapy. I needed help understanding what it was that I was going through. I needed help understanding that I wasn't alone in what I was going through. I needed help understanding that what I was going through wasn't going to be permanent, but that wasn't going to be it. So, you know, there are a lot of things, there's a lot of work that had to be done, not just, you know, by myself, or I had to get help. I had to get some understanding because there were answers that I didn't have. There were questions I didn't know to ask. So I'm glad I did that. And, you know, now once my daughter graduates in the spring, I'm hoping to get back into baseball. I'm hoping to be back, you know, maybe in front of your television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on someone's network and talking baseball again, or, you know, maybe on the radio or something, or who knows, possibly even in uniform coaching some team. Whatever it is, I'm looking to get back in baseball, and, you know, I'm hoping to do, you know, connect with some teams this spring, but, I mean, this winter, you know, let them know I'm ready to get back in. But, yeah, I totally shut it down for a couple of years. And, you know, if there's any players who hear this out there or who might be, you know, getting ready to go into this, man, you know, understand that life is changing, and yeah, after baseball becomes something different, and you need something to dedicate yourself to. You need something to get up for in the morning, and you also need to understand that if you live long enough, hopefully you're going to be an ex-ball player much longer than you ever were an actual ball player.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a major league baseball player. So don't let that define you. Don't let that control your views of your self-worth. You know, and be glad that you had it as long as you did, but keep moving, keep working for something else.
Yeah, I think it's commendable you not only going to therapy, but talking about it, because, you know, I think in regards to mental health, especially with men, I think things like the conversation around mental health for men specifically, I think it's getting better, but there's still a stigma there, unfortunately. And, you know, hopefully that continues to progress to people being more open about it. And just back to your point, excuse me, regarding, you know, when a baseball player retires and now you're home all the time and there's a huge adjustment, I would kind of liken that to the pandemic for a lot of people currently, where, you know, I'm a stand-up comic. I have not done a show in a club since February. My bright idea was, and it shows how making plans really doesn't fucking matter. Nothing is really in your control. I've been doing stand-up almost 13 years. I decided I would take a couple weeks off at the end of February, early March, and then March 22nd, get back into it, record an album in April. That March 22nd show never happened. I've been home since March 12th. But I do also work in corporate finance by day. So I would be gone 60 to 65 hours a week, Monday to Friday, and then do shows a couple nights a week. And then every single weekend I'm doing shows Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday, but now I'm home all the time, all the fucking time. And my wife and I, excuse me, we're not about to get a divorce or anything, but it's certainly, it caused a huge strain on our marriage, and strange too, but mostly a strain on our marriage for the first probably month or two that I was home, because I'm working crazy hours and trying to parent. So I can certainly, at least to an extent, relate to what you're saying there, so far as it being a very big adjustment when your routine changes so drastically. But you had your eldest daughter when you were still playing, and so that kind of mirrors what your upbringing was like, I would imagine, to an extent. And so how, if at all, did the fact that you experienced that as a child assist you in parenting in the same situation?
Well, I think you have, you're aware. I think the first thing is, you know, you have to be aware of certain things to even know that they're happening. I think, you know, being in that scenario as a kid, having my dad travel and play, you know, living that, I think I have a, it's in my consciousness, understanding that life is different when dad's not around. You know, life is different when you know, you see other kids, parents at games or at events or plays or whatever, and your dad isn't there. And it's not because they don't want to be there. It's just because their chosen profession doesn't allow for that to happen. You know, but I mean, you know, there's also things that in my daughter's life I can't imagine. I've never been a teenage girl, mm-hmm. much as I've said, I've never been that. So I can't possibly think that I know those things or know how to navigate that. I don't. So I had to really also sit back and realize that. I'm like, yeah, I may have gone through that situation, but everything that goes into that scenario, as far as she's concerned, really may not even have much to do with my views of how it happened at all, because she's a girl. You know, there may be so many other things that she's dealing with socially, you know, in her life that I can't even possibly imagine. So really being there is all I could do. Having my presence there is all I could do. I had to rely on, you know, almost every scenario when I'm trying to figure out what to do with my daughter, I'd ask my sisters. I have two sisters. I ask my mother. You know, I go through other women who have been through these stages to make sure that I'm not making a foolish decision or imposing some idea on my daughter that's unfair. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like the council of the elders that you go through to try yeah. to figure out to make sure that you get it right. And, you know, as a parent, I think one of the things I'm glad I learned was it wasn't about being right, it's about getting it right. So, it's, you know, it's not, oh, I'm dad and I say this, and well, you know, no, that's not the answer, because that may be the wrong answer, because along the way, there's a lot of things that my parents and my family taught me that I had to unlearn that I thought were right, and ended up being absolutely wrong.
Yep.
So, you know, we have to learn to get it right, and it's not about being right simply because I said so.
That is an excellent point, and it covered another question I was going to ask, is the point that you bring up where, you know, sometimes you have to unlearn things. I'm very fortunate. You know, my parents are together for, what, 41 years now, something like that. I get along quite well with them. It's weird. So I grew up in Oakville. They, a couple of years ago, downsized a little bit to a smaller house here in Oakville. My wife and I moved back here. We're both from here about a year and a half ago. So they're about a 5-minute drive from where we live, which would be very convenient for help with childcare if there wasn't the whole virus thing going on. So it's essentially the three of us are bubbled in our house, and that is it, especially with how bad things are here in the greater Toronto area. But my dad called me up. He called me up last weekend. And he was like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, oh, good. You know, we're just catching up, whatever. We talk fairly often on the phone. And he said, our next door neighbor's house is for sale. You should buy it. And I was like, yeah. That was how I reacted too. You spent so many years essentially trying to get, you know, raise me to get me out of the house. I don't know if, Preston, if you've watched Everybody Loves Raymond. But that's exactly, yeah, well, that's the fucking situation. I was like, Dad, no, you're out of your mind. But they're lovely people. But it's just like, that's something I often think about where, you know, I'm very lucky. I'm fortunate that I had a good upbringing, no real major issues. But yeah, there were certainly things that I needed to kind of deprogram and kind of get out of my head. But you have two daughters, and they're, what is it, 13 years apart in age? Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. One's 18 and one's five. One's graduating in high school in the spring, and you know, if all goes well, they'll be going into first grade in the fall. I spread that out pretty foolishly, but it's also in a way where I get to see them both go through. You know, I get to see them each, you know, individually go through it all. You know, hey, you know, as they say in hockey, sometimes you sneak one past the goalie.
There you go. You certainly did. Yep. I was going to make a joke again, but I'm not going to be crass. So we'll end on your joke there.
I had a follow-up on that one in my head, and I let it go too.
Okay, good. We're trying to keep things a little bit classy here. I'm glad we're on the same page there. And so in parenting your older daughter, were there any things that you kind of picked up on and you're now able to employ in fathering your younger daughter?
Yes. Even though all kids are different, a girl's feel like things a lot more. Like a little boy, and I have, you know, being the oldest in my family, I've grown up around, you know, little boy cousins. I was the, you know, de facto babysitter a lot of times with the kids around the house. I mean, my five-year-old right now, I can hear her at the door because in her mind, she knows, you know, dad's supposed to be done a little while, so I hear her. I've learned that a lot of little girls, and not all, but they tend to feel things. So you have to be very careful about how you say things. You have to be very careful about how you go about giving them information, how you go about correcting them. And it really takes you back to understanding that your father, your mother, like these people are gods to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like your father, these are your gods. These are the people who have created your world. So when you do things in a way, make sure that there's always, even if you're disciplined, you discipline with love, you discipline with compassion, you discipline in a way that it's not just you venting what you want them to do, but you're helping them to understand how they need to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
It teaches you patience. You need to understand, like, a five-year-old kid is not a little adult. That bothers me to no end when somebody say this. No, that's not a little adult. They cannot process information the way that we do. They don't feel about things the same way. Things that mean so much to us mean nothing to them. Like, you could have a painting in your house, and they draw on it with a crayon, and you're looking absolutely ballistic. But you know what? That doesn't mean anything to them. Tens of thousand dollars don't mean anything to a kid. They see that as something colorful and beautiful.
Yeah.
So we have to adjust our thinking and make sure that we are not setting our kids up for failure. Because if you're the type of parent that put that painting in their reach, that's your fault.
Yep.
Because that painting doesn't mean anything to them. That means something to you. So we have to make sure that we're patient. We have to make sure that we're understanding that we're not setting our kids up to fail, that we're not getting upset with them about information that we haven't given them yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Being a parent, watching my first daughter, it taught me to have compassion in everything I do with them, even though some of it may be corrective, even though some of it may be teaching. And also it taught me to be congratulatory more often, because me as a guy, we were told, well, you want congratulations for everything? Like, that's what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You want a celebration for you, you know, putting your plate away? No, you know, like, no. So, you learn that in order to encourage that type of behavior, yeah, you want to, oh, great job, baby. Thank you for putting your plate away. That was really great. You
mm-hmm.
know, Ava, I'm so glad you picked up your toys. That was a wonderful job. Yeah, even though you were supposed to do it, you still need to congratulate that to reinforce that as a positive behavior. And I had to learn those things, because when you're a kid, especially a young black kid growing up in the South, you know, whatever, it's like, yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. Now go about your day. Like, there's no reinforcement.
Okay? Yeah.
There's no, oh, great job. Hey, man, hey, you got good grades. That's awesome. Well, good. I'm glad you got good grades. Okay, you know, keep going. You know, that's what it was for my parents.
Yeah.
Then if you didn't get the good grades, you know, then it was to come down. But, I really had to learn better ways of communicating. I had to relearn. I had to learn how to go about dealing with my children to get the outcome that I want, but provide them with the avenue to do it so that they felt like they could own it and mm-hmm. felt like they could feel accomplished in it. And do that all while not demeaning them or making them feel that's what I had to learn, and I'm still learning it every day, man.
Yeah, that's something my wife and I employ as well, where, you know, exactly what you're saying. Like, hey, buddy, can you please pick up your toys? And, you know, when he does, thank you so much. You did a great job. All that positive reinforcement, exactly what you're saying. I guess we're kind of fucking corny. We came up with a cheer for our son when he does something well. And now he'll clean stuff up and then do his own custom cheer. And it's hilarious. And my wife and I are fucking dorks. and so the final question.
And your child is going to be absolutely, you know, that's going to help him a lot.
I hope so.
But when you do those dorky sellout type things for your kid, it means the world to them and it's going to be better for it.
I certainly agree. He smiles from ear to ear when we do it. And so the final, I don't want to keep you too long. The final question I like to ask is essentially, if you could go back to just before you became a parent and give your past self a piece of advice, what do you imagine that might look like?
First advice that I will say is listen to hear and not to respond. Really hear your child. Really slow down and hear where they are coming from and understand that they're not processing this moment the way that you do. So you really need to slow down, hear what it is that's bothering them, hear what it is that they're trying to express, and then figure out how to do it. And that you may not be able to do it in that moment. You may say, okay, baby, give daddy a minute or two to think about it, and I'll tell you. Because sometimes we were taught that a parent has every answer. No, a parent does not have every answer. A parent does not know everything. And sometimes in our need to be that God in that moment for our kids, we give an answer right away. And sometimes it's not a very well thought out answer. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not even a very well reasoned answer. It's an answer that we've heard. It's an answer that we think will satisfy the moment. But more than anything, that first thing is listen to hear, really hear what your kid is trying to tell you and listen to how it affects them, how what they're saying, you know, listen to what they're really feeling. And the other thing I would say is every decision that you make, the first question that you ask yourself is, how is this going to affect my child? Or how could this affect my child? And if you ask yourself before every decision, as a parent or before, those will be the first two ideas that I would start with that I would tell my future parent self.
I think that's probably the best answer I've received. And I've done 40 episodes. So you're ranked number one. For sure. So, no, I think that's excellent advice. Preston, I really do, appreciate you doing the show. Hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend.
No problem. You know, thank you for inviting me. I know it took us a while to get here. It's been crazy down here, man. But I'm very glad that I got a chance to come on with you now. I'm glad I was able to keep my word to you and get on here with you. So take care. Wish you and your family all the best. Love up on that boy.
You bet.
And, take care of your wife, and we'll get through this thing, man. Not just through this pandemic, but we'll get through this thing called life a little bit better. People just keep trying.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks again.